Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Big manifestation on campus. A student leader takes us inside the encampment she and her classmates have set up in support of Palestinians. And despite the crackdown at other schools, she says they're not going anywhere.
Nothing to see here and nowhere to see it. The government of Burkina Faso shuts down the Human Rights Watch website and suspends international news outlets for covering an investigation into a massacre.
Fight and Flight, the government agency that deals with airline complaints, is way behind, to the tune of tens of thousands of outstanding claims. And an advocate for passengers' rights says that's not going to fly.
Speaking truce to power, a new documentary offers insight into Afghan peace talks with the Taliban from the perspective of four women negotiators. They say the process may have failed, but that doesn't mean the Taliban has won.
Are they good at walking? There's ample evidence. Two athletes from BC will keep up a blistering pace when they represent Canada in the first ever mixed marathon race walk at the Olympics. We'll hear their concerns, which are frankly pedestrian.
And on Brief Debrief, a Nigerian YouTuber tells us she loves nothing more than talking to people, but breaking the Guinness World Record for interviewing 90 people over 55 hours nearly broke her. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that loves a good back and forth. And fifth and sixth, and seventh and eighth. In one picture, Texas state troopers in riot gear stand opposite a group of demonstrators whose arms are linked. In another, there are tents pitched on a campus lawn in New York. A sign reads, Gaza Solidarity Encampment. They're just two of dozens of dramatic photos from college campuses across the U.S. in recent days, as pro-Palestinian protests have spread from coast to coast. It has been tense. Some schools have sent in the police, and there have been hundreds of arrests. Nyanta Nepal is a third-year biomedical engineering and education student at Brown University. She's a member of the Brown Divest Coalition, and she's taking part in her campus encampment, which is in its third day. She's also the undergraduate student body president-elect. We reached her in Providence, Rhode Island, earlier today.
Nyanta, can you describe for our listeners the scene around you, the encampment?
So it's a beautiful day outside. We're on the main green. There are a bunch of tents set up in the middle of the quad. A huge crowd, I would guess, I'm looking around, somewhere between 200 to 250 people are engaging in different forms of programming. There are tarps set up for art builds, a bunch of signs hung up around the tents. There are people flyering and having conversations with different people on the green. Kafias everywhere, a lot of solidarity, just a really, really beautiful sight.
It sounds like a very different situation than what we're seeing on other campuses where there are similar protests and similar encampments. The response has been different. Why do you think it's been different on the Brown campus, at least this time? I know at a sit-in in December there were arrests, but so far we haven't seen the same kind of response. Why do you think that is?
So our university is not averse to using police. I think this encampment has specifically like this kind of national precedent that's been set, that it's also okay to depart police brutality. There was a statement released by our president that she would not go to that extent unless we decided to take further escalatory measure. That being said, she is still getting IDs checked, threatening conduct violations. And I think ultimately what we're made aware of is, although we are not in the same position as other universities in the country, we are in a position where all of these universities, students are demanding an end to the complicity we have in the ongoing situation that's happening in Gaza. All we're asking for is our universities to divest and end that complicity, because we do not want to be associated with that violence anymore.
I want to ask you about that part of your protest, divestment, in a moment, but I will say we reached out to officials at Brown, and they wrote back to us saying in part, quote, "Encamping on the university's historic and residential greens is a violation of university policy, and therefore the appropriate conduct steps will be taken, but encamping itself is not an arrestable offense," end quote. You are student body president, but are you concerned that that role is in jeopardy?
Not at all. I ran my campaign on divestment. That was what I listed as one of my priorities, was to ensure further advocacy for my university to divest from systems that are allowing for the ongoing violence on the ground in Gaza. And I am committed to that. And I was elected on that platform. So I would expect nothing less than to be at this encampment for its entire duration, to be supporting my fellow students as we all take a stand. I think that it would be, quite frankly, ridiculous to expect me to do anything else. The situation in Gaza is dire right now. It requires everyone to stand, to be loud, to acknowledge what's going on and see it as something that's horrible, and use every ounce of privilege we have to advocate for it.
Many experts, as you may have read in all of the coverage of everything that's happening across the country on campuses, many experts have pointed out that they believe, based on their research, that focusing on divestment is not actually going to yield the kind of result that you want, because universities, whatever they're funding, it's so small, it's not going to change any particular firm's actions anywhere. So why continue to focus on divestment?
So I think there are two parts to that. Universities hold a very, very important status in our country. I think that they are leading in research. They're leading in a lot of different moves that are happening politically. They're also empowering the next generation of students who are going off into the world. So if my university is actively investing in something, whether that be a small portion, a large portion, whatever that is, it is my university that's choosing to invest in that. I am complicit by nature, regardless of the amount. And when I'm accessing my higher education, it is morally and ethically its responsibility to not be invested in systems that perpetuate that. In addition to that, it sets a social precedent. There is a symbolic meaning behind having universities divest, and that is that companies cannot get away with perpetuating and supporting an occupation that is violent, an occupation that is killing thousands and thousands of children, mothers, families, tearing apart lineages of people on the ground in Gaza. Universities have no business being a part of that. And if we divest, then it also holds more corporations and companies accountable to their actions moving forward.
There are Jewish students that are part of your protests, part of your encampment, and part of encampments on campuses right across the U.S. as well. I believe you also had a special Seder as part of your protest at one point as well. But you also know that there are students, Jewish and otherwise, who disagree what is happening on your campus and others. One, Daniel Solomon, just an example, was quoted by a local TV station, WPRI, saying, "We really enjoy the green space of the university, and to see it being used in a way that really makes Jewish students and Israeli students feel so uncomfortable is very concerning." There are people on other campuses, Jewish students in particular, who've said they've faced anti-Semitic comments, they feel threatened. What do you say to Daniel Solomon and other students who feel what is happening with these encampments is a direct threat against them?
I can only speak for myself, and I can only say that when I am sitting in my classroom engaging in normal university activity, all I can think about is the fact that there are children and families dying in Gaza. And that is what makes me feel unsafe, is to know that my university is invested in that. When I'm sitting in my classroom and thinking about that, I feel unsafe daily. When it comes to being in this encampment, I've never felt this amount of showing and solidarity and support that I've felt since I've been here.
Mm-hmm. If a Jewish student who is feeling unsafe came up to you and wanted to have a conversation and wanted to share why they feel unsafe, what would you say to them?
Yeah, well, first I would listen to them. I would not feel the need to respond right away. I would love to hear what concerns that they have with the movement in terms of what in its nature of Brown divest now is making them feel unsafe. And after hearing out their concerns, I would respond in a way that shows them that we have nothing but kindness and compassion for them, and to do the same, to share my own opinions as to why I'm here, why I felt empowered to move, and that the reason I'm taking action is because of atrocities that I see. It's because I'm racialized in the same way as Muslim and like Brown students on this campus, and that's why I feel like I'm called to action. That reasoning is different for everyone, and I would want them to feel able to engage in a dialogue with me, and I'm compassionate to listening towards what they're experiencing.
In the Washington Post's reporting, they've spoken to historians, and some describe these protests as the biggest and most consequential, potentially, of these kinds of protests on campuses that they've seen in recent years. How do you hope history will look back on this moment and what you and your classmates are doing?
I think that it will look at it the same way that it looked at South African apartheid in the 80s. I think it'll look back at it as it's looked back on anything. It'll look back at it through a lens of potential co-optation of the university trying to take credit for the student activism that's present here today when they did nothing except try to suppress it. And I hope that people remember the fact that throughout all over the country, youth, students have the power if they come together in coalition and a collective to really, really push for change and to really demand change and to never forget that as we continue to take action. And that requires bravery and that requires really leaning on those who have been directly impacted as the Palestinians have been.
Niyanta, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Of course, I appreciate it.
That was Brown University student and protester Niyanta Nepal in Providence, Rhode Island. Regarding the group's calls for divestment, Brown spokesman Brian Clark said to us that the school's position had not changed and the endowment is not directly invested in defense stocks or large munitions manufacturers. He also told the Washington Post earlier this year that the endowment is, quote, almost entirely invested through external specialist investment managers, all with the highest level of ethics and all whom we believe share the values of the Brown community. This includes the rejection of violence, unquote. The number of unresolved complaints against Canadian Airlines now matches the population of a small city. The federal government's Canadian Transportation Agency is dealing with a backlog of 71,000 disputes between travelers and airlines. The CTA admits that number looks bad, but says it is making progress. In the last 7 months alone, it has processed 11,000 complaints. But that's not good enough for Gabor Lukash. He's the president of Air Passenger Rights. We reached him in Toronto.
Gabor, as you know, the federal government has committed to speeding up the process to get through these complaints many times. They've said they're committed to that. You don't think it's working. Why not?
The system itself is broken in more than one way, unfortunately. Last year, Parliament directed the government to impose a cost recovery fee on airlines that generate those complaints. Even though it is on the law books now, the government is sabotaging Parliament's will and has not put in place that cost recovery fee that would actually be a disincentive for airlines to push passengers to all the way to complain to the Canadian Transportation Agency. An even greater problem is that the regulations themselves are written in such a way that is very labor-intensive, evidence-intensive to deal with the adjudication of just a few hundred dollars.
Even though it is taking a long time to resolve these complaints and there is this very large backlog by any measure, but couldn't it be said that this increased number of complaints actually means that Canadians are understanding that they are entitled to compensation and applying for that compensation?
The increased number of complaints confirms what I told 7 years ago to the House of Commons Transport Committee, which is that the Liberal government's proposed legislation at the time would double the amount of compensation that passengers do not receive. There are all these rights now that look great on the paper, but passengers are still not getting what is owed to them because airlines are sabotaging the law. Airlines are refusing to pay what is owed to the passengers, and they are doing so because rationally, economically, it is far cheaper, far more economical to disobey the law than to comply mm-hmm. with it.
Almost a year ago, we spoke with Omar Al-Ghabra, who was at the time the transport minister, about his new passenger rights legislation. And again, it was supposed to make it easier for Canadians to get compensation. As you know, I just want to remind our listeners of that conversation. So we'll play a short clip of that.
Airlines will tell you that they feel these regulations are tough. These regulations are shifting the burden onto airlines, so no airlines can no longer avoid compensating a passenger for something that they're responsible for. These new rules, as I said, are the toughest in the world, and it's going to make our air travel system better, more efficient, and more reliable.
He says they're the toughest in the world.
Those comments by Minister Gabra were ridiculous, and they are affront to anybody who has ever traveled and dealt with actual airline compensation process. quite the opposite is the truth, in my opinion. The gold standard is what we have in the European Union, and Canada is nowhere near that. The greatest problem in Canada, apart from the wording of the rules, regulations, which create no lack of compensation as the norm and compensation as the exception, the greatest problem in Canada is lack of enforcement. The Canadian Transportation Agency has a cozy relationship with the airlines, is not independent in reality, and they are not actually using the powers that was given to them, that Parliament told them to use, to create financial consequences for airlines that break the law and don't compensate passengers as required by the law. That is why we see such a ballooning number of complaints, because airlines don't do what the law says, and they have no financial incentive to comply with the law. It's just currently cheaper for the airlines to fight all these complaints, occasionally, as the worst-case scenario, in a few cases, be told that they have to pay, because even when they get caught red-handed disobeying the law, the worst consequence for the airline typically is just having to pay the passenger the compensation and maybe some nominal slap on the hand, but nothing comparable to what you would see in the U.S., where airlines are being issued millions of dollars in penalties when they break the law.
Let's talk about the other kinds of complaints that you're hearing for passengers who may experience them on their next flight or have already, just to illustrate the kinds of complaints that they can launch and should launch in your view.
What I can tell you is that we recommend passengers to avoid the Canadian Transportation Agency at all, both because of the big backlog and because of the concerns about its impartiality and lack of independence in treating passengers' complaints. So we recommend passengers to take cases to small claims court and all together avoid a Canadian Transportation Agency.
And will they actually get compensation, though?
Yes, passengers will get their fair hearing where an impartial judge or adjudicator is going to look at their complaint, and that is far more than what passengers can get today from the government, from the Canadian Transportation Agency.
And in the meantime, what do you think will actually resolve this? You mentioned you've been pushing for this for many, many years. We've certainly had many conversations with others. You mentioned the conversation with the former minister. What's it going to take then to bridge this gap between what you and some others are suggesting and what government officials are saying?
First of all, Canada needs to harmonize its regulations with the European Union's gold standard. The European Union's system may not be perfect, but when it comes to how much effort it takes to enforce it, it is proportionate. They got right the basic ideas of make a system simple, but only a few hundred dollars are at stake. Make it easy. The second thing that needs to happen in Canada is meaningful enforcement. Currently, we don't have any form of meaningful enforcement in Canada. We only have some, window dressing. I think that's the best way to describe what the Canadian Transportation Agency is doing. There's no financial incentive for any airline to comply with the law.
Gabor, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gabor Lukacs is the president of Air Passenger Rights. We reached him in Toronto. Kerry Clark has said it was like Galena just vanished. Earlier this month, the Utah resident realized her 6-year-old cat, Galena, was missing. She searched for her for days, but nothing. And then she got a call from California and was stunned to hear that the person on the other end had met a close friend of hers. We reached Kerry Clark in Lehigh, Utah.
Kerry, how's Galena doing today?
She's doing great. She's so happy to be home. She's very lovey and just wants all the snuggles, and we're so happy to have her back home after this crazy adventure that she's been on.
So if we go back, how did Galena end up traveling hundreds of kilometers from your house to California?
Yes, it is quite the story. She's an indoor cat, and so she's usually around me pretty often, and we could not find her anywhere. We tore apart our house looking for her. We put flyers mm-hmm. across the neighborhoods around us and in our neighborhood. We spent hours upon hours searching for her, and she was just nowhere to be seen. We spent a whole week trying our very, very best to find her. I got a phone call, and it was from first I got a text on my phone that told me that Galena's microchip had been scanned and that she had been found. And you can imagine my excitement when I got that text. Yeah, and then within 30 seconds of that text, I got a phone call from a vet in California. And she told me that Galena was safe in California, that they had found her, and that Brandy, an Amazon worker, had rescued her. Yeah. And she was in California, and I just couldn't even believe it.
Yeah, the fact there are many things that are unbelievable here. How do you think Galena ended up in the return box? I mean, if it was an empty box, I can see her playing around in it, but the box got taped up and labeled and shipped out.
How? I know. It's such a sad circumstance. What ended up happening? No, we did not ship our cow out intentionally at all. Never, ever would we do that. We love Galena. I've had her since she was a kitten, and she is a part of my everything. And what ended up happening was my husband had a big, giant Amazon box. It was a try before you buy. It's about 3 feet by 3 feet, like that, those were the dimensions. Mm-hmm. He was trying on some work boots for his job, and he ended up, you know, keeping one pair, and then he returned the other 5 steel-toed boots and put them back in the box. And unfortunately, when he left the room to go and get tape and scissors to seal the box up, that's when Galena must have jumped in on her own, because she loves to play in boxes.
Sure. Is she a quiet cat,
though? Part of her personality. Oh, she is so quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, she's definitely a very shy cat who loves to hide. And in the past, we've let her play in the Amazon boxes, but not anymore.
The Amazon worker, Brandy Hunter, you mentioned, said, you know, her coworkers actually called her because she's known around there, as her words, the crazy cat lady. So it's, however unfortunate it was that Galena got in the box, she found the right person to take care of her until you could come.
Absolutely. It was a miracle that Galena was sent to Brandy's warehouse, because Brandy is known to be the crazy cat lady who loves cats and knows all about them and all about their behavior. And she was the only one who knew that this was an accident. She was the one who assumed goodwill, and she knew that it was an accident and it wasn't on purpose. And
she knows that cats can get up to trouble.
To our cat.
She knows that cats
can get up. Absolutely. She knows that cats hide in boxes, and she knows that she could tell that she was a cat who was loved.
They did not ship her back, though. You had to make your way out to California, right?
Absolutely. How quickly? Not. Right. So once we found out what had happened to her, like that giant bombshell of news, we immediately booked a flight to California the next morning as soon as we could. And we hopped on the airplane, and we coordinated with Brandy and got to talk to her on the phone about everything. And we decided to meet up at the vet's office, and that was when we had our big reunion together. And I got to meet Brandy, who rescued our kitty, and I got to see Galena again. And it was so emotional. It was just amazing to see her and how well she looked, and how it was just miraculous that she had gotten through everything she did.
Well, because work boots, I mean, they're heavy. And if they're being jostled around with her in the box, I mean, it's quite remarkable that she's okay.
Absolutely. The vet, you know, gave her a big, huge physical. We took blood work with her. I mean, it was hard to put her through more things, but, you know, you need to do that to make sure she's okay. He said that she was probably a little bruised here and there from those work boots, but there were no broken bones, and all of her blood work came back completely normal. It's a complete miracle.
How long was her trip?
She was in a box in a truck that had traveled from Utah to California for 6 days without food and water.
Oh, Galena. Well, it is remarkable.
Yeah.
So advice to other cat owners, or do you have new protocols in your home for when those deliveries arrive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My new motto has been to spay, neuter, and microchip your pet and triple check your Amazon boxes.
It's a good saying. Bob Barker's not around anymore to say that after Price is Right, but
yeah.
But you can continue on that tradition with the additional.
Absolutely,
Carrie. I'm glad Galena's okay and that you were reunited. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and talking with me about the story. We're happy to share the miracle of finding our cat. And we're so incredibly grateful for Brandy, too, for all of that she did.
You have a new friend in California now.
Yes, absolutely. To rescue our cat and just all of the goodness that she shared with us. We're so thankful for her.
Thanks for this, Carrie.
Thank you so much. Bye.
That was Carrie Clark, the owner of Galena the Cat in Lehi, Utah.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
The government of Burkina Faso doesn't seem to be very happy with Karine Kaneza-Nantulia and her colleagues. Ms. Kaneza-Nantulia is the Africa Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch. Yesterday, the campaign group released the findings of an investigation into what it says was the massacre of more than 200 civilians by members of Burkina Faso's military in February. The government has responded by shutting down access to Human Rights Watch's website in Burkina Faso. It has also suspended the broadcasts of both the BBC and Voice of America, two of the outlets that reported on the massacre investigation. We reached Karine Kaneza-Nantulia in New York, and just a note, some of what she has to say is disturbing.
Karine, how is your organization, Human Rights Watch, reacting to Burkina Faso's decision to shut down your website?
I think we've responded to the government's decision. Blocking free speech or blocking access to our website does not really address the issue at hand, which is the executions of at least 223 mm-hmm. civilians, including 56 children, in what may amount to crimes against humanity. And what we are very clear about is that it's urgent that the government conducts clear, transparent, swift investigations, and that the support of the UN and the African Union is clearly very much needed.
You've mentioned the children and the civilians. Why were their villages targeted on the 25th of February?
First of all, we go back to February 24th and in the morning of the 25th, where Islamist armed groups carried out several attacks across the country on military targets and on civilian infrastructure as well, such as religious sites. And they killed scores of civilians, soldiers, and militia members. So we have to analyze these mass killings in the context of retaliation. At the same time, they seem to be part of a generalized and systematic attack against civilians, which is why we have said that they may amount to crimes against humanity.
The country's Superior Council for Communication says Human Rights Watch made, quote, hasty and biased declarations without tangible proof against the army, end quote. What kind of evidence does your organization have to back up the findings in your report?
Our findings are based on standardized conventional research methodology, the analysis of satellite imageries, the analysis of pictures, videos, photos taken by survivors. We've talked to survivors, we've talked to experts, we've talked to members of civil society organizations. And I would like to take a moment here to also, I think, remind everyone that these survivors and these villagers went to introduce a complaint at the gendarmerie on February 26. They went to the gendarmerie brigade in Wahiguya to make a statement, which led the High Court prosecutor to announce an investigation. So the courage, we have lists of names of the victims. But ultimately, the courage and the resilience of the Burkinabe people, these survivors, is crucial, really, and important to recognize.
For those of our listeners who haven't read your report or read the survivors' accounts, is there one that you could share for them to illustrate what they described?
Some of the accounts that really stayed, at least for me, this young man, for instance, who told us how he lost every single member of his family. One day it was a family of 13 people. Today he's alone. He's lost his brothers, siblings, his mother, his father, everybody. Another one lost 16 members of his family, including his wife. I think the other accounts that really tell a terrible story is how some of these survivors survived because they, for instance, took the blood coming out of the person who was next to them, put it on them to pretend that they were dead, and had to emerge from a pile of dead bodies. So that's obviously a horrible, atrocious, inhumane situation to find for anyone to find themselves in. And I think finally, it's what stays. It's what stays after all this. Mm-hmm. It's the post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
It's hearing how they have nightmares, that they cannot sleep, that they keep hearing the gunshots and the screaming. They keep seeing their loved ones. Yeah.
How could they not?
Yeah.
The government there, as you know, is suggesting your investigation and reporting on it may create public disorder. That may sound like a familiar justification to our listeners. What do you make of their response?
Indeed, it's part of a broader trend in the playbook of any autocratic government to silence dissent, to silence any opinion that will not necessarily reflect what the government's position is. So that's the first thing. Second thing is Burkina Faso forces have been fighting an insurgency by the Al-Qaeda-linked group called the Janim. And the second one, the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. It's been a protracted, long, atrocious Islamic insurgency. At the same time, the militarization of any, the super-militarization of any response is playing in the hands of the armed Islamist groups. The grievances, the death that's being unleashed upon civilians is not necessarily going to reduce the threat. On the contrary, human rights abuses, mass atrocities constitute one of the driving factors in the recruitment by Islamist armed groups. Lastly, if anything, our findings and our report shows the urgency for the government to react. And I think their reaction says something about how difficult and how urgent this investigation is needed. That's all I can say right now.
Karine, I appreciate your time.
Thanks for inviting me.
Karine Kaneza Nantulia is the Africa Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch. We reached her in New York. Given week, Neil does a dizzying array of interviews, 7 to 9 every day. Let's do some back of the napkin math here. Cumulatively, that's about five solid hours of interviews every single week, week in and week out, all conducted at this rickety card table in this drafty studio with what I am pretty sure at this point is a family of hybrid raccoon possums living in the ceiling. Anyway, by that measure, Nigerian YouTuber Clara Kronberg recently did 11 weeks worth of interviews in a little over 2 days. Over 55 hours and 24 seconds, she interviewed 90 people back to back and set a Guinness World Record for the longest interview marathon in the process. It was a grueling schedule made maybe a little more tolerable by the fact that it took place on a yacht in Marbella, Spain, but maybe a little less tolerable by the fact that she skipped bathroom breaks to give her guests a platform. We reached Clara Kronberg, whose voice is still recovering in Marbella, Spain.
Clara, I certainly do a lot of interviews for this program, for As It Happens. I might interview 90 people in 10 days, maybe 12 days. You did that in a couple of days. Why?
Yes, because I wanted to take myself out of my comfort zone. I love hearing people's story. I'm always inspired and pushed by success stories. And honestly, it's like, what's next? What's the next thing I can do? I wanted something, you know, to prove that you're not limitless, like literally impossible is not existing. So, that was why, honestly, just why to just push myself beyond limits. Yes.
You did this on a yacht. You are still on that yacht. That might make it easier to recover. And I do like our studio, but I'm saying a yacht. I mean, I may have to put in a request to our executive producer. But how are you feeling after? Because I mean, you just had 5 minute rests in between, right?
I mean, it was really a lot. I would say, to be honest, physically, emotionally, mentally, is a lot going on. Mm. However, I think, like I always say, if you love it so much, your will guide you, will see you through, that's all. So my will was the reason why I was able to get through it. Because if you ask me tomorrow, how did you do it? I have no idea, you know, and 5 minutes to rest is not enough. You know that yourself. So it's literally like, oh, you have 5 minutes, take a break. And no, it doesn't happen.
You're thinking about the next interview or what you wanted to talk to that guest about. So how did you coordinate all of that?
No, I didn't think about that. Mm-hmm. Everything was intentionally planned because I knew that, you know, there will be some change of guests and all of that. So what I did, because I produced the whole, interviews, literally the whole show. So what I did was I intentionally made it about storytelling, about your story. What I need is your name and what you do, and that's all. Mm-hmm. I'll take it from
there. Yeah, if you're interested in people and love to hear their stories, exactly. I can relate, exactly. Certainly. But exactly. You do have to have contingency plans. People can cancel. Timing doesn't work out. Yeah. Connections don't work out. We have a team of wonderful producers that help make sure we get those guests and line up the interviews and the backup plans. So you did have some help around the world to have backup plans, right?
Of course, my team, like there is no way I would have done this without incredible team. They were able to run on the streets. They would pick up. honestly, there's no way. It was incredible team. They pulled through. And sitting down there, I was no longer thinking of what would happen. I just trusted them.
Yeah,
I wouldn't lie to you. I trusted them.
You have to. And thank goodness for wonderful teams like you and I both have and the conversations we get to have. We're really lucky. But when you do so many back-to-back, I mean, can you remember what any of these 90 guests had to say?
Yes. I remember so many of them. I remember so many. There's some of the interviews. I think earlier I was mentioning that I love the fact that, you know, I was able to get in these people to tell stories that they've never told before. Yeah. So I remember those special people who opened up their personal life they never talked about. The lady with her mother's relationship, you know, the way she saw her mom, the way she still sees her mom, we talked about it and it felt like a healing moment. Like it was so therapeutic. There was this lady as well that talked about her marriage and how her brother rather, you know, abused her when she was young. There was this guy who talked about her, his experience in being a human rights and lawyer. I mean, I remember most of the interviews. Jeez, I remember. I remember.
They stay with you. The most moving parts. So you have, you know, you're successful on social media, on YouTube. You have your show. You've achieved this record now. What do you want to do next?
Thank you for that question. I am constantly on the quest for more, which is I am so hungry to hear more stories. I am hungry to share more stories. So hearing more stories means interview more, because there are a lot of phenomenal people out there, especially the women. I am hungry to one day interview Oprah Winfrey, the legendary Oprah Winfrey. I am hungry to, you know, to make great stories in terms of filmmaking through my, you know, online. I want to build an online TV. I am on the verge of doing that, by God's grace. But it's a quest for to tell stories to impact positively in the society and be among change makers in my little way. You know, this is what it's about at the end of the day. I am inspired by people's story, because I once had, you know, I am a dreamer. Yeah. I'm a dreamer as well as a realist. So I grew up from nothing, and I just being able to tell my story, I want so many stories to be told as mine is being told. So I am hungry for that, to tell many stories through interviewing so many others, and as well make movies, films, web series, you know, host events, all of that. I want to be part of that. I want to be part of a positive change.
Well, Clara, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Rest that voice, though it does sound pretty great after 90 interviews. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Take care.
Clara Kronborg just set a new Guinness World Record for longest interview marathon. We reached her in Marbella, Spain. It's a film that is heartbreaking before it even starts, because we already know how things will end. This weekend, The Sharp Edge of Peace premieres at the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival in Toronto. The film follows four women in Afghanistan as they prepare to sit at the negotiating table with the Taliban in 2020, ready to fight to ensure justice for women. That, of course, does not happen. You likely know what follows: the withdrawal of American troops, the fall of Kabul, and the erosion of women's rights since the Taliban takeover in August 2021. But the film also reveals the dedication of these four activists and their resilience as they push forward against all odds.
If I tell you that the first time when I came to this building and I started talking, I was 27. I'm 67 today, and I'm still doing it, for God's sake. Wake me up from this constant nightmare. I mean, we deserve peace, and we deserve a fair peace.
That's Fatima Gailani speaking in a new documentary called The Sharp Edge of Peace. Roya Sadat is the film's director. She joined Neil in the As It Happens studio. Fawzia Koofi is a women's rights advocate and a former Afghan politician. Along with Ms. Gailani, she's one of the four negotiators featured in the film. We reached her in London.
Fawzia, you have offered our listeners over the years several times a window into what has been happening in Afghanistan, what you have gone through, what women are still going through there. But knowing where we are today and having lived what you've lived through, what was it like for you to watch the film and relive those negotiations?
Well, I really hope that the endings of the film was a different ending. It was an ending that we initially hoped for. It was an ending I was hoping that would result a more happy ending, an ending that will respond to the expectations and the desires of people as we first started to film this documentary. However, things went ups and down, and we didn't really get to where we were hoping and we were wishing and we were striving. The collapse of the government, the way that, you know, millions of Afghans had to leave their home country and fled, and for several times in their lifetime, they had to leave everything behind, and especially some of us. So it was, when I watched initially, it was a moment of happiness, because to include four women in the negotiation was not easy. Mm-hmm. It required a lot of struggle from our side. So it was about women's power and about how much difference they could bring to the table. But the end was not a happy ending, as I said. We were hoping that it would end with everybody clapping to see a government that is representative of all segments of the society.
The film begins in your hospital room, Fazia, after you survived an assassination attempt. You were shot in your shoulder and hand. And we see, you know, with you and your cast throughout the film. But as it happens, you were a guest on our program at that time about the attack and your hopes for the peace process at that point. We'll play a little bit of that for our listeners.
I think that's what these people want, whoever behind this is. They want to give a message, and the message is clear. They do not want an Afghanistan where every individual, man and woman, have equal rights. I cannot say really anything on behalf of Taliban. What I can say is I'm sure that intra-Afghan negotiations will start hopefully soon, because we need to do that. There is no alternative. I have kind of almost lost my right hand in addition to whatever else that I have lost in the war. But I still want to go to these talks with this injured arm, because this is a symbol of how desperate we are for peace.
How desperate you were for peace, Fauzia, but also determined to get equal rights for women. And you was also said in the film, peace is not just about silencing the guns.
Indeed. I mean, we wanted to have a peace with dignity and a peace with justice. And as I said again, and I would like to repeat, for me, peace was not something that the Taliban now claim that they have brought security. Peace is when I feel I and many women and men in Afghanistan feel safe, protected, feel equal, feel included in every sphere of their life. It's a different level of war now in Afghanistan. It's a war against women. So definitely we started with a lot of hope. And from the moment that we actually struggled to include women was not easy, because even our negotiation with some of our own leaders, like the democratic leaders, was not easy. When we wanted to ask them to include women, they were like, really? Once we make the decision, we will include you. They never believed that women should be included from day one.
Roya, I'll bring you in now. You know what it is like to grow up under Taliban rule. Can you describe a little bit about that and how it shaped you as a filmmaker?
You know, as I have experienced first time when the Taliban took over the country and I was at school, I think it's the most darkness part of my history in my life. And you know, right now when the people around the world, they are just listening that it's about 3 years that Afghan girls, they cannot go to school. I living in that moment. I understand the situation and how it's difficult. Like in this age, when you're a teenager, you're starting to drawing your dream and you build your future. And then everything is broken in the darkness. And even you don't have your basic choice, basic rights, like education is the basic rights. This is the real rights of the people. But in that moment, I remember that many women, many girls, they are teenager, and they was forced to marriage, and it is automatically coming because the people thinking, okay, right now the clothes is banned, the school is banned, and we have like 2 girls or 3 girls. They don't have any future, so like the only choice and the good choice for them to be marriage. Like, we never imagine, I always thinking that when you're talking about Afghan girls and Afghan women right now, you just imagine your daughter in age of 10, in age of 8, in age of 15. Like, right now, the girls who was 14 years old, now she's 18. And maybe with all the dream that she had, now she became a mother. And she's just only a housekeeper, like a housekeeper. And this is the future of a nation. This is the future of a country with full 40 million people. So I can feeling each all the moment that this 4 years, I tried to don't interview. I was focused with my films. Mm-hmm. You just put your inside of like a shelter, like what you're imagining with your passion. But inside of me, each moment I living with them because I have this experience.
You do get a few seats at the table, Fazia, as we see in Roya's film. The Afghan government sent 21 members or delegates to this, four of them, though, only four, were women. And when you do get a seat at that table, the four of you, as we see, you're sitting in a room with members of the Taliban, people, men who don't believe you are equal to them or should even be sitting there. What was that like for you?
It wasn't easy for me because I was the first woman to be involved in the dialogues before the negotiation with the Taliban. And I remember when they put my husband in jail, when they banned education for every girl, when I was a student at medical college, when they first took over, and eventually they put my husband in jail for 3-4 months. I had to visit my husband in prison every time. They insulted me, disrespected me. And I could see in front of me other women also were beaten up, whipped, disrespected. And how they changed our society in the first time they were in power. And the second time they were fighting, you know, very professional people, my professors from university, my friends, colleagues were killed in the either suicide bombing or, you know, in the battlefield mm-hmm. or targeted assassinations. So I had that grievances with me. But, you know, the first time when I saw them in Moscow, I was not sure whether to enter the room and face them or not. But I think one thing that actually pushed me to enter the room and to take my seat and to take my seat powerfully was the fact that, you know, from a time where I was regarded as nobody, as invisible, a second-class citizen, when they were in power, to the time that during the negotiation, now I was sitting across the table with them mm-hmm. and proudly representing my country. So I was feeling powerful, I was feeling legitimate, but in the meantime, I was feeling also, you know, much more aware, much more educated about what the needs of my people are. Every mm-hmm. woman, when they are in that room, when they are in the negotiation, when they are in the decision-making process, when you are in that position, you need to take all the preparations. And mm-hmm. I was prepared. And my perspectives and the perspectives of other three women, sisters, my sisters, were much more different, much more enriched and based on the ground realities in Afghanistan, which made us feel different and empowered than the Taliban.
In addition to the important content of what you had to say in those meetings and presenting yourselves and being prepared, as you said, there's also a moment in the film, Fawzia Roya, that you and your team captured when you talk about what you were wearing on your feet, high heels, not because they're comfortable.
It was a very, very weird evening because we had a dinner with the Taliban. So the table that I was supposed to sit was like the most radical, and now all in the leadership of Afghanistan, like the deputy prime minister, the minister of mines and petroleum, all the ministers and the deputy ministers were sitting in that table. Initially, when I went, it was full, but I went there and I said, I'm going to share the table with you. So they didn't look at my eyes, even they didn't look at my face. And one of them, he was like, I don't want this woman to sit with us. And the moment I heard that, I was like, I'm going to sit in this table because this is my chance. Either I make myself visible and sit, despite the being unwanted, or leave the negotiation and leave it forever.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of quite struggle to sit there. And at the end of the dinner, I think we managed to have some exchange few words and have some conversation. And when the dinner finished, I was so angry that I just walked with my high heels, producing a lot of noise. And I knew that they don't like it. They don't like to hear a high heel of a woman because they think it's provoking them. And I said, I'm doing this intentionally to just provoke them, because with every voice that is produced from my shoes, I want to revenge from everything they did to the woman.
You are listening to As It Happens. I'm Neil Kirksal, and in studio with me tonight is Roya Sadat, director of the documentary film The Sharp Edge of Peace. Also joining us on the line is Afghan women's rights leader Fawzia Koofi, who has been a frequent guest on our program and is also profiled in the documentary. We've talked about sitting across from the Taliban, and Roya, you and your team are capturing those moments. But there's also references in the film to successive U.S. administrations, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, letting Afghanistan down, but specifically the women of Afghanistan. And we get the sense that, as we learn more, that these talks really were doomed from the start, because the Americans had already made a deal with the Taliban without conditions, as you talk about. And Zalmay Khalilzad is the former U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation. We have a clip from him when he's being questioned by U.S. Representative Stephen Lynch in Washington. He's meeting with the women in the film, the three of you, and he says, "You can count on us." But we hear something different in that other testimony.
We were told by the Afghan team and the U.S. team that the status of women and girls in Afghanistan was not a lead priority for us, that it was going to be the part of the Afghan government to negotiate that. Am I wrong in that?
That has been a general directive that I'm operating under.
After all we've been through, the most important accomplishment, I would think, in 50 years looking back, we taught 250,000 Afghan women how to read and write. It's probably going to be the biggest impact in that country in the next 50 years. It'll be the one accomplishment that we can look at that made a difference. And yet, the rights of women and girls was not included as a priority for us going into the negotiations, and the Taliban knew that.
Roya, why was it important for you to include that moment?
When I started for this documentary, I was like with hope. And at least we're thinking maybe the Taliban became a part of government, not more in power. But at least the security situation became changed for the people. But of course, when I enter with the women, not only the Taliban, but the government also, our camera was very sensitive for them in different way. I think maybe first of all, because we informed them that I'm falling for women, and my producer also independent filmmaker, and I'm independent filmmaker, and we want to following our four characters, this brief women to want to going to sitting face to face with the Taliban. And this title, documentary and women, it's become very sensitive. Not we understand Taliban, we know the Taliban, but for me the government was shock, because we go and knock door by door to. Finally, we enter with the media, and but as I see that these four women always they talking about meeting like with I don't know the internet, because there was international community from Norway, from Germany, from United States. We should talk with these people and be careful about the women. So they was wondering. They was totally different than all the men groups, even from the public government. You know, when you make a movie, it's very important your heart. Running behind the story, not only your treatment and your theme and subject. So I see how they struggle, not only trying to talking with the Taliban, but with international community also. This one was one of the meeting that they talking with Khalilzad. He's the representative of United States with the peace negotiation. And of course, he was in the high position in that moment. Mm-hmm. But the sentence that he said that, count on us, this was like, you know, always it's repeated in my mind that it will be like this or not.
Did you believe him?
So empowerment is the first priority for, you know, for the political leaders. And then with this sentence, we see the news and on the media that Mr. Khalilzad talking totally different. So, at the same time that I'm living, of course, in the United States, it's a very hard situation too. But when I'm entering inside of the movie, I ignore that where I am. And I want to add one thing, that for this, in this movie, for me, the meaning of losing and winning is totally different. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling the women of Afghanistan, they're winning. They're not losing.
Even now.
Even now, because they're in the stand in the right side of history. They're the only force that you can believe them, that you can do believe them that their struggle is for freedom, their struggle is for democracy, for women's rights, for human rights. They're the only force to stand in front of Taliban, and all the world ignore the situation.
Fauzia, I'll ask you a similar question. Did you believe him when he said, "You can count on us"?
Ambassador Khalilzad.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think he played a very double and even triple game and role in this negotiation. Many people in Afghanistan see him as somebody who played a very wrong and negative role in this. He was trying to please every individual in their own way, but at the end of the day, he actually pleased the Taliban. So I did not really, when we met him several times, we said that, you know, why did not you include one word of human rights and women rights in the Doha deal that you signed with the Taliban? And his response was that, you know, our soldiers are not in Afghanistan to be killed. With the cost of their life, protect the women rights in Afghanistan. And our answer was, but we thought in 2001, in October, when you came to Afghanistan, you said you are there to dismantle Al-Qaeda and weaken Taliban and help women of Afghanistan fulfill their rights. What happened? Many people in Afghanistan feel betrayed. Many women feel betrayed by empty promises they made, I would say.
They feel abandoned by the United States.
They feel abandoned, and also they feel that they were betrayed. I mean, they feel that they were used as a weapon.
Roya, you live in Washington, D.C. now. Given that feeling of betrayal and abandonment, what is it like for you to call that now home, in a way, Washington? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that when you know the history?
You know, that time I was in Seattle, I had a contract to direct an opera. Mm-hmm. And me and my husband, that he's a co-producer also for this movie, we had planned to go from U.S. after the pre-production of opera to Doha. But when the situation happening, of course, we didn't have any choice to go back. And you know, when you're in exile, it looks like you lose yourself. And that moment, it was really shock for me, even for weeks and weeks. I just imagined that I see the, like, dream or not, this reality of today. Yes, but I don't know. I just want to say, for any people who wondering about the future of this world, you know, what happening in Middle East, in Afghanistan, and in Gaza, in different countries. So you just imagine if we have a empowerment women, political women, I don't know, in different country, mm-hmm. like, do you think they will be a witness of this kind of agreement to totally ignore the women of Afghanistan? Maybe not. Maybe the situation be totally different. I always thought that, okay, I'm a filmmaker. I don't want to talk about politics. But after Kabul falling, no, I just thinking each movie that I'm going to making, I should be carried at what's happening. And how can I drawing my message? So I think we need power women in politics. This is very important. And right now, we're just hearing the school is banned in Afghanistan. Of course, the school is banned. But there is 100 madrasas open. And many teenager and young generation in the future of a nation, you know, their character is building inside of the madrasa. That they just receive lessons like extremists and fundamentalism. So it should be an alarm for the world. And the situation of Afghanistan not only belong for Afghan people.
Do you feel, Roya, that this gave you a sense of identity back? You said being, you know, exiled, you can feel like you're losing your identity. Did making this film give you some of that back?
I think it's still not, because not only the story of myself. I'm talking about the thousand and thousand women and girls in Afghanistan, that they are every day they wake up without any hope, anything. And when I see they are in the middle of, like, you know, the darkness moment, and I cannot even enjoy what I having, maybe the good time or the peaceful time with my kids. Every day when they go to school, I just thinking, and sometimes I crying that, okay, right now my daughter can. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You don't need to apologize.
So as you see that right now, it looks like when the bigger tragedy coming, it's eating the small one. But for me, tragedy is tragedy. War is war. And living under the control of terrorist groups is tragedy, the big tragedy. But unfortunately, sometimes when the big topic coming, it's like right now what happening in Ukraine and in Middle East, and then the media and the people totally forget Afghanistan. But there is still like a open prison for women and for people.
Pazia, let me ask you. You know, I know you still speak with women in Afghanistan whenever it's possible, whenever it's safe. How are they describing their fight right now?
I do speak, and I think they're resisting in their own ways. For instance, they still continue to have home-based schools, discrete schools, and it's heart-wrenching to see after like all the struggles we put, all the progress we had, and we took it so much for granted that, you know, this is now a fundamental right to access education, and we codified it in the law on violence against women in the Constitution of Afghanistan that anyone deprive a woman from her rights to work and education is a crime. But when I open my phone's messages and I see that, you know, in a province, in a remote area, a girl is being taken from her school for teaching other students to Taliban's custody, and she's being imprisoned. It is very emotional, because why would somebody be in prison for going to school? Mm. Why even education is a crime? Where is Afghanistan going? It's not even about women's rights. What is the destiny? What future holds for Afghanistan, for my country, for my people? In that sense, it's very, very emotional, sad, and sometimes even I get emotional and like my mind shut down, and I'm I feel the burden on my shoulders. Like I just feel the sky has fallen to my shoulders. But when I see that this woman at the end of the day, with mediation from her community, her husband or her father, she is released. And the next day she comes back to school. That is a story of resilience. That in her own ways, she demonstrates resilience and strength and persistence and hope for a better life still. So I think that's something that keep me moving and keep all of us moving. And I think that's the hope that we should keep up, and we should continue to support those women, because I think future will be this time shaped by women of Afghanistan.
Fauzia, Roya, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Roya Sadat is the director of The Sharp Edge of Peace, which follows the four women delegates in the 2020 intra-Afghan talks. Among them is women's rights activist Fauzia Kufi, who joined us from London. The Sharp Edge of Peace screens this Saturday and Sunday at the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival in Toronto. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.